This is Jane again. I'm just waiting for the operator to come on, and he will introduce the talk. I mean, not introduce the talk. He'll talk about the recording.
This conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you. Well, my name is Jane Houston Jones from Cassini Outreach, and I'm going to be your host today, but I'm also going to try not to talk a lot because I'm home with a cold. Our speaker today is Dr. Bonnie Baratti, and the topic of her talk is the search for activity on icy satellites that aren't Enceladus. Dr. Baratti serves as the principal scientist here at JPL. She has degrees from MIT and Cornell. She began working on Voyager data of icy satellites, and she's been involved with Clementine, Deep Space One, Cassini, and now New Horizons mission to Pluto, as well as Cassini. I'm sure she works on some other missions, and what I'm going to do now is turn it over to Bonnie, to Dr. Baratti, and take it away. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks so much, Jane. Really happy to be here. I'm really excited about the subject, and just in the last few months, I've been searching for activity on some of the icy moons. We all know that I think there have been previous charmed telecons on the activity on Enceladus. So I'm going to start out as a review by talking a little bit about, you know, satellites and moons in general. I use the term moons and satellites kind of interchangeably. I'll try to say moons because that's what most people think of. I want to give some kind of background information and also a little history of how we found the activity on Enceladus to lead up to the search that I'm currently conducting for possible activity on other satellites. Let's see, if you have my presentation, the second page here, I'm sorry, I realized I didn't put page numbers on there, so I'll try to say what's on each. You know, fortunately, there are only 24 slides, so it shouldn't get, I'll try to spend some time on each slide. First of all, I'm just going to talk about how we found activity on Enceladus, because it kind of led up, you know, many people suspected this, and it was kind of a detective story about how it happened. Then I'm going to give a brief review of some of the tantalizing evidence that we've, Cassini scientists have uncovered for plumes or any type of activity. Plumes is kind of a general term for activity on other icy satellites. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the more specific search that I've been conducting over the last just few months for plumes on Mimas, Tethys, and Dione. These are three icy moons of Saturn that are the most likely to be active. I also want to say that I've been working with students on this. I had a student, in fact, work for me this summer. His name was Sean, and he was a student from MIT, Sean Falk, and graduate student and has actually done a lot of this work with me, so it's an excellent opportunity for students to get involved in this work. So that's an overview of the talk. Let me just move on to page 3, which is outer planet satellites in perspective. The reason I show this is just to kind of show you the types of objects that we're looking at, and it's amazing because, you know, if you look at the Earth's moon there on the upper left, it's kind of a big moon. In fact, the ratio of the mass of the Earth to that, the Earth's moon to that the Earth is higher than any other such body except for Pluto and Charon, the demoted planet, the outer solar system. It's actually a dwarf planet, so we can still call it a planet. But it has a moon. Actually, it has three known moons, but the other two are small. Charon, which I don't actually have on this graph, is actually more massive in comparison to Pluto than the moon is to the Earth. But other than that exception, the moon is, as you can see, it's quite respectable. I mean, the Earth is a small planet. Maybe one day we'll have to face our demotion from the family of planets. But you can see that it's comparable to the largest satellites, moons in the solar system, such as Ganymede and Titan. But what I'll be talking about today are these tiny moons. If you look at Saturn, you know, Saturn has basically three types of moons. It has the giant Titan, which is in a class by itself. Then it has these medium-sized satellites, which are Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Dione, and Rhea, which kind of make up almost a small solar system. a mini solar system around Saturn, because they have regular orbits. They're all in the plane of equatorial plane of Saturn. And Iapetus also would be in that category for size, but Iapetus is kind of odd. It has an inclined orbit, and it's very, very odd. And then there are these small satellites ranging from Hyperion and Phoebe down to these small outer irregular satellites, and then the small inner satellites. They're kind of the third class, the small satellites. But what I'll be talking about today are really those medium-sized icy moons of Saturn. The only thing that we have similar to that in the solar system are the Uranian satellites. There you see down below Miranda, Ariel, Umbriel, Titania, and Oberon. And interestingly enough, some of them show evidence for fairly recent activity and resurfacing. So let me just review what the icy moons are in the solar system. Io, you see there the Jovian satellites, the four main satellites are Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, the four satellites that Galileo found exactly 400 years ago. Io has massive sulfur and silicate volcanoes on it. It's a very active object. The other active object is Triton. You see that there at the lower right. We have found plumes or geysers on Triton, but it's not nearly as massive as those we found on Enceladus. The thing that is powering the plumes on Enceladus is internal. There's a liquid water ocean and lots of heat that we believe is caused by tidal interactions between Enceladus and Dione and Saturn. Whereas Triton, the plumes on Triton just seem to be the polar cap kind of evaporating, or sublimating, I should say. So Triton is active, Io is very active, and Enceladus is very active. There's some evidence that Europa might be active, but we haven't caught it in the act yet. We're going to be looking at that very closely over the next couple decades. So let me just move on to the fourth slide here, properties of Enceladus. I want to make a few points. These are just some numbers here if you're a number-type person. First of all, it has a fairly rapid month. As you know, the moon goes around the Earth once every, about 28 days, whereas Enceladus moves around Saturn about once every 1 1/3 days. So it's an inner satellite. It's a small satellite, as I said before. Not as small as some of them, but it's really has about a 500-kilometer diameter. But the most amazing thing about it is its geometric albedo. Let's just think of that as the brightness of it, okay? It's 1.4, okay? That is greater than unity. That means it actually focuses the sunlight back to the observer. Just for comparison, the moon has an albedo or reflectivity of about 0.1. That's 10%. We think of the moon as being pretty bright. So this object reflects 1.4. That is more than the light that falls onto it. Now, it hasn't got an internal heat source or a light source. It simply focuses the radiation back to the observer. Freshly fallen snow has a reflectivity of about 80 to 90%. So this is the first hint that something might be unusual about this satellite. It is brighter than anything we know of in the solar system. It is as bright as something that's very fresh. So that kind of indicates that there might be some activity on that. We knew that even from ground-based observations. Voyager discovered that was kind of confirmed it. And that was when people started getting kind of suspicious about its activity. Or the possibility that there might be activity on it. The moon was discovered in 1789 by Herschel, who is kind of the grandfather, as it were, of modern astronomy. He was the first person that really observed extensively, had a telescope, is the discoverer of Uranus, and he's really kind of the intellectual grandfather of us all. So let me move on here to the fifth slide, and basically there are two pieces of old data here, because I want to kind of present this as a detective story. You know, what were we thinking about Enceladus up until the point that we found the plumes? Now, in the lower right-hand corner, you see an image of Saturn that I actually took in 1997 from the 60-inch telescope on Mount Palomar. This was for an observational project I was doing. And this was a very rare event, okay? This was during the, happens only once in the season of Enceladus, about once every 12 years, where we see the rings edge on. Okay, in fact, we just went through another such event, but I've been so busy working on Cassini that I didn't get any time to observe Saturn through a telescope. But those of you that have ever seen Saturn in a telescope know that the rings kind of are very bright, and the scattered light from the rings kind of just blot out all the inner satellites, because so you can't observe them very well. In fact, Herschel found Enceladus during a ring plane crossing. So if you look at, this big object in the center is Saturn, and then those little funny ears sticking out are the rings. I didn't take this image right at ring plane crossing, because it turns out from California, where I was observing the ring plane crossing, the moment of equinox was not during the night. It happened during the day. So this is, I think, a little bit after ring plane, a few hours after ring plane crossing. So even then, you can see the rings start to come into view. But there, sure enough, and quite frankly, this is the only time I have ever seen Enceladus in a telescope. This is an image, a CCD, charge-coupled device image. That little object there on the left is Enceladus. And there on the right, you see, on the right ear, you see Venus, okay, which is even interior to Enceladus, and you can only see it clearly during a ring plane crossing. And those other three objects are the outer Tethys, Dione, and Rhea. But now, prior to the Voyager encounter of Enceladus in 1981 and 82, you can imagine if you were an astronomer, the only thing that you could see of Enceladus was basically a point of light. Everything you had to find out about it was just by studying this point of light in your telescope. So can you imagine the excitement of astronomers and geologists when they saw, this image that I show here on the top, which shows Enceladus from about 100,000 kilometers away? You can see, first of all, some of it's cratered, some of it's very cratered, but you'll notice through the center of the disk, or the partial disk, there is a terrain that looks like it's smooth, or no craters on it, which in planetary geology means that it's recent. You have, what really looks like a faulting system or maybe some type of activity. Let me talk more about this on the next slide. This is slide number 6, geologic terrains of Enceladus and albedo, or reflectivity. This is a first hint at true oddness. Now, on the right there, this is from an article in Science magazine that I've reproduced. Geologists like to make these colorful maps that tell you the history, the geologic history. Well, that's what this is on the right. These different colors simply mean that they're different terrains with different histories and different ages. So you see that kind of light orange terrain and the darker oranges. Those are the plains. And those are areas that are very young. They have virtually no craters. In fact, that one that you see, SP2, the Smooth Plains 2, really no craters were found on that. And then you see this interesting feature that kind of goes into the crater terrain. It looks like it might be a fault with some activity. But in addition to that, you also see some areas that are very heavily cratered, and that means that they're older terrain. But the amazing thing was, and this was some work that I did there on the lower left, you see that little number B0, okay? That just means how reflective the surface is. Don't worry about what it means. It just means how reflective. It means basically that it reflects 82% of the light. Roughly, that's what it means. And you'll notice that no matter what terrain you're looking at, whether you're looking at the smooth plains, they're recent, less than a billion years old. Now we know they're much, much more recent, but back then in 1982, that's what we thought. To the crater terrain, which really dates from the earliest ages, of the solar system. All these terrains, whether old or young, are the same brightness, which is high. It basically appears to be coated with fresh snow. And many of us back then thought that there had to be some activity on Enceladus, some type of geysering or plume activity, which later came back onto the moon and coated the surface, uniform coating of snow on the surface. So that's kind of the first hint. That was, 25 years ago. All right, so let me show another interesting image that was really intriguing here on slide number 7. Do people want to ask questions now or at the end? How do we usually do this, Jane? Do we wait till the end? Hello?
It sort of depends on your preference.
I don't really mind if people interrupt with questions.
Okay.
I will, we're saving some time at the end, but if people have a specific question or if I'm getting too technical or too jargon, let me know.
Yeah, and if anybody does want to ask a question, state your name, and then that shows up in the transcripts. That helps so that the text file is complete. So thanks, everybody, and I'll turn it back. And if you do have a question, go ahead and ask.
Okay, yeah, I'm glad to entertain questions, especially if I'm not being clear or, if I'm using too much jargon.
Okay, it's great so far.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go back on mute.
Okay. So here's this slide number 7, Enceladus and its environment. This is an image that has really fascinated me for years on the left. It's a Voyager image that was taken in 1981. It's a Voyager, I believe it was Voyager 1, which actually went out of the solar system. But this is a low-resolution image of what looks like a blob, a very bright blob. And, here's an object, a moon, that's already, about as reflective as you can get. It's covered with, fresh snow. But here's an area that's even brighter. Okay, so I was always fascinated by this blob, and I didn't really think it was a geyser, but it looked like some very bright deposit, something special. The other thing about Enceladus, which I'm going to show later, and if you want to go ahead, you can. Enceladus is in the midst of the E-ring, which is this massive distended ring of small ice particles in the Saturnian ring system. It lies outside the main ring system. It was actually discovered from ground-based observations. I can't remember exactly what the date of its discovery was. I think it was the late 80s. It wasn't discovered by Voyager. It was discovered by, the late 70s, around 76, Thaum et al., late 70s. Discovered this ring, and it seemed to originate in Enceladus because the thickest and densest part of the E-ring is at Enceladus. So here on the right is a map of Enceladus from Voyager, and that blob appears right on the edge of our kind of high-resolution images. The high-resolution images only covered about a quarter or less of the land area of the surface area of Enceladus. So Voyager gave us some tantalizing images that didn't tell the whole story. So now here is an image that was taken on slide 8. I have an image here that was taken, and most of it's illuminated. It's taken at 94,000 kilometers. This is a Cassini image. This was an image that's kind of the same distance that the Voyager images were taken. But look how much better these images are. The camera was much, much better. And you can see, again, there's some areas there that are heavily faulted. Looks like there's some troughs and faults. And there in the lower left, at the south pole, you see that it's like a garbled terrain. That's going to be very, we're going to find out that is very interesting, but it seems very strange. But, again, there are also some areas that are heavily cratered, like the Earth's moon or some of the other inactive satellites, that there's some primordial crust there that has been, relatively untouched except for this coating of fresh ice from the creation of this moon. Now, let's kind of walk through historically here. See, that was slide number 7, number 8. And here I have this arrow here that shows where the area of that Voyager 1 bright feature is. Okay, we can see that it's kind of in one of those cracked areas or faulted areas. If you look at slide number 9.
Bonnie, this is Dave Duty. Could I ask you about 8? Is the background light because of the E-ring?
That's a good question. I think that this, what has happened, that's partly it, but I don't think that's mainly it, because the E-ring actually is so tenuous that even if you look at it with the imaging system, it would still be very dark. I think that is what has happened. I believe this is a press release image, so it's probably been stretched, and it's stretched so that, you know, some of the small numbers in the background are kind of stretched up. But I think you're right. I think, for example, if you look on the dark side, okay, the dark side, the terminator there, it's actually darker than the background. So either this is the E-ring, or it's been stretched or filtered in some way to make the dark background appear grayish.
Thanks.
I'm not sure it's a real effect, because it's a press release image, and you never know how those have been processed. Okay, so moving on here to Rev 3, this is like 2005, Enceladus 003. Here are just some highlights of this flyby. On the upper left here, you see these cracks, huge cracks in the surface. And it also looks like there have been episodes of cracks. You see that some of the cracks lie on top of the other cracks. And some of the cracks, you know, some of the faulting and geologic activity must have taken place in the recent past, because on the right image there, you see there's a lot of faults and cracks, but you also see some craters there. The craters' impacts are very infrequent. So even though there are some areas of Enceladus, some of the most recent areas, like there on the left, that's very recent, you see no craters, there's some other areas that show evidence of activity that are older, that have some craters. So we know that this is episodic, that whatever is happening, you know, has happened over the history of Enceladus. And there, on the lower right, I show some VIMS data. That's just to remind people that imaging is not the only data we get. In fact, you will see that some of the crucial data was given to us by other instruments other than imaging. So Enceladus, during the Enceladus 3 flyby, we didn't see any activity. We just kept seeing this weird appearance of Enceladus. Okay. And the same for the targeted flyby on Rev 4. We didn't see any activity. However, we saw, now here's an image on that, on slide number 10. We see there, the upper right, you see some older craters that look like they're slumped and filled with, well, quite frankly, looks like snow. And then on top of it, there's this cracking, this fault system. But again, we also see images such as in that lower, the lower image, cratered regions that are older. So one thing I didn't mention is that the density of the bulk density of Enceladus is actually higher than the other icy moons. If you go back to, I think it was slide number 2 here. I'm sorry, no, it's slide number 4. Density, this is in grams per cc. It's 1.6 grams per cc. Now, ice is around 1. It's a little bit higher if it's compressed. But if you look at the other icy moons, they range from about 1. In fact, I think Tethys is slightly below 1, up to about 1.2 or 1.3. But Enceladus has a slightly higher density. It's quite substantially higher than just ice. And what that means is, you know, the only thing, way we know of to get a density like that is to have a rocky core. Okay, so this rocky core has some radioactive elements, things like uranium, mainly uranium, and other radioactive elements that give off heat. So that is one hint as to what is happening on the satellite. There seems to be an anomalous sort of source of heat, and this is one of the sources. Although we believe that the main source is tidal friction, that Enceladus is in what we call a resonance with Dione. for every two orbits that Dione makes, Enceladus makes one orbit, so that, you know, every two orbits, it ends up in the same place as Dione, which, and Dione is a pretty large satellite, it's much, much larger than Enceladus. It essentially exerts a tidal force that causes Enceladus to kind of flatten. And when the moon is on the other side of Dione, that flattening kind of releases. And it's this kind of flattening in and out that finally ends up as heat in the interior of Enceladus. That's what we believe the major source of that is driving activity on Enceladus. But some of the details haven't been worked out yet. So let's move on to slide number 11. This, you know, in many respects is, I think, the most interesting thing, because, you know, we were seeing images of Enceladus and it looked really odd, but we couldn't really figure out what was happening. So the first thing that happened is the CDA instrument found what was some evidence for an atmosphere on the two earlier flybys, the ones on Rev 3 and Rev 4. They just found out, now this is an instrument that detects dust, and when I say dust, it could mean, you know, rock particles or water particles. When they say dust, they actually mean water particles. When they got near Enceladus, they found evidence for an increased abundance of ice particles, you know, beyond the background of the E-ring. So this was, you know, the first kind of hard evidence. Then there was also evidence, you know, I have written here that it's evidence for a magnetic field, but I think it's more correct to say that the magnetic field of Saturn was kind of draped around the body of Enceladus. If you look at this picture here, those little loops you see are actually the magnetic field lines from Saturn, and there's a plasma flow that comes out that is entrained along those lines, and those field lines drape around Enceladus as if there's something holding it back. I think we first thought it was a magnetic field, but now we know it's actually particles that are pushing back those particles and the magnetic field of Saturn. If there were no plume there, no particles, it would just impact the surface of Enceladus. So this was very, very intriguing. If there was something there that was causing the magnetic field of Saturn and the particles that were entrained in that magnetic field to kind of back off. Okay, so we got really suspicious. Does anybody have any questions? Because I know I've really thrown a lot of facts and there's a lot of complicated stuff there. But that's the key point. That was what kind of really... That we started to get a handle on what was happening when we observed that.
Bonnie.
So a lot of us went in, the PI of the MAG instrument and the project scientists, deputy project scientists, people that were running the satellite observations. We went to the project and put in a pitch to lower the altitude on the second targeted flyby, which was on Rev 11. That's EN-11, Enceladus Rev 11, down to 175 kilometers. You know, we had never done anything like this before, but, you know, we were just going to go for broke. And the project agreed. They agreed that this was very, very tantalizing, this result. Now, let me kind of get back to ground-based observations. Well, before I do that, I want to emphasize a couple things here. First of all, you'll notice that the first evidence, for oddity on Enceladus, the first tangible evidence came from instruments that were not imaging systems. One was the cosmic dust analyzer, and the draping of the magnetic field was discovered by the MAG team, the magnetometer team. I think also found some evidence. So it was really, they were the key instruments. The other point I want to make, we go on to the 12th shot, 12th slide, entitled Mysterious Telescopic Observations. Even though spacecraft give you high-resolution images, you still need, and a lot of data that's right there, you still need to rely on ground-based observations, because there you get a huge handle in time. All right? People have been observing Enceladus for 1780, over 200 years. So there are a lot of ground-based observations of Enceladus that go back to then, and studying those, we can get some kind of an inkling of what has been happening through time. Now, I went back and kind of looked at the historical observations, and it turns out that Percival Lowell, he's shown here in the upper left, he was kind of a grandfather of observational astronomy, but he came from the Lowell family of Massachusetts. It was a Brahmin family from Boston. They were very wealthy. His dad was president of Harvard, and Lowell Mass is named after them, and Amy Lowell was the sister, the poet and Asian scholar. And Percival, his dream and his passion was astronomy, and he put some of the family's millions of dollars into building a huge observatory. At the time, it was huge, in Flagstaff, Arizona. That was where the air was clear, unlike the cloudy skies of Boston. And he went there to do studies mainly of Mars. He was really fascinated by the possibility of life and civilizations on Mars. But he also observed the planets and the moon. And there are some observations by Percival Lowell and Schleifer in 1913 and 1914, which were during another ring plane crossing, another equinox period. They showed an increase of 0.3 magnitude. This is about 30%. This is a big increase in astronomical terms. In the brightness of Enceladus at what we call western elongation. Okay, that just means the trailing side. It is the side we would see where we now know the activity is. I mean, it's in the southern pole, so we can't see it very well from Earth, but this would be the best view from the Earth that we see. And this is also when we were looking at the southern pole. The sub-observer latitude, spelled latitude there wrong, was minus 32 degrees. So it was, I made a mistake. It wasn't during the ring plane crossing. If the sub-observer latitude is minus 32 degrees, it's not going to be during the ring plane crossing. So that's a mistake. This was not during the ring plane crossing. It was during a period when we got the best view of the South Pole on Enceladus, when the areas that we now know is active had a kind of the clearest shot. So they observed this fairly substantial increase in brightness. And then there was another observation in 72 and 73, also during a period when we see the southern pole most clearly from Earth. They observed a brightening of 0.3 magnitudes at western elongation. That's when we see these tighter stripes, or the best view. So this is kind of intriguing. These observations exist. I'm somewhat skeptical of that first one, the first observation. But the second observation was done by two very careful observers. And, it kind of suggests to us that, if this is real, that maybe these plumes are very, very variable, because it would be very difficult to see these plumes from the Earth unless they were very bright. Okay, so let's just move on. Let me cut to the chase here. That is, when we found plumes on Enceladus. So here's the discovery. Here is an ISS image on the left that shows you in the left there, the lower part, you see the so-called tiger stripes, which now we know are the active areas, these faults, they're almost like they could be plate tectonic subduction zones or convection areas. This is where the plumes are coming out of. And, the actual, I'd say the smoking gun was discovered by the infrared experiment. On the right here is a rendition of the temperature across the active areas, where it goes from these are in absolute. So it goes from 60 Kelvin up to 91 degrees. Now we think that I think the latest observations by Sears suggest that the temperature there is up to 170 or even higher. And there's I think overwhelming evidence that the source is liquid water, that there is a liquid ocean underneath the surface of Enceladus. So Sears was kind of the smoking gun, and then the images that you see here in 15, UGRAPH number 15, the smoking gun, These are the plumes that are actual geysers that which represent ice particles, water ice particles being expelled from the Tiger Strikes. There's nothing like this in the solar system that we know of, at least nothing that's going on right now. So this is, I think, one of the greatest discoveries of the Cassini mission. Let me move on here to the satellites that we're now looking for possible activity on, the new work. And here's an image by Dave Seal here on slide number 16. And it shows the inner satellites, Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Ione, and Rhea. And it shows the E-ring, which, as I said before, is created from the plumes coming out of the Tiger Stripes. The E-ring is densest at the orbit of Enceladus. And we believe that the tenuous extended form of the E-ring are particles that just kind of come out and get entrapped in these more extreme orbits. But I think it's a very fair question to ask, are there other icy moons of Saturn that have similar but low-level activity? So there's been a lot of intriguing evidence, some of it very similar to the early evidence that we dug up on Enceladus. So let me review some of this. First, the most, I would say, likely ones are Dione and Tethys, and here's a picture of Dione there at the top, and Tethys there is at the bottom. Now, these bodies are very bright. They're not as bright as Enceladus. They're not like freshly fallen snow, but they're kind of like dirty snow. You know, if you live in a part of the country where, you know, you have a lot of snowfall, you know that at the end of about a week after the snow forms, it gets dirty, and like you have this slurry and slush. That's kind of like what these objects are like. But you'll notice there's some interesting features. For example, on the top one of Dione, you'll see there on the left there's kind of like a fault zone. These were the famous wispy streaks that were discovered by Voyager. And we thought that there was actually maybe ammonia being expelled from fault. But now we know it's actually a fault zone. And the brightness is due to changes in particle size, but it may be due to some material being that might be expelled from that fault zone. We just don't know. And you also see that there's some areas, especially if you look at Tethys there in the bottom, in the lower right, you can see some areas. I mean, they're not as smooth as the plains on Enceladus, but, you know, geologists have done crater counts and have found that, you know, they are just much more recent than, for example, that area you see up at the top. And there are fault zones on Tethys that remind us of some of the fault zones that we see on Enceladus. So they do have some of the same geology. Now, there's a couple of, I think the most convincing evidence that there would be activity on these bodies is that the fields and particles instrument, and this was published by Jim Birchall, in an article in Science in 2007, that there are features in the plasma coming from Saturn that are best explained by having two plasma streams, that is, you know, plume-like structures that come separately from Dione and Tethys. Okay. This is kind of similar to the type of evidence we were seeing on Enceladus, where you had the magnetic field being disturbed by this and kind of draped over Enceladus by this kind of atmosphere, as it were. There's another evidence, and that is that VIM saw a possible atmosphere on Dione. The VIM's instrument just saw off the limb. It looked brighter than it should have. So these are two likely candidates. There are other possibilities. Mimas, which is the inner satellite, would also be subjected to tidal forces, which is the source of heat for Enceladus. Unfortunately, we haven't gotten too many very good images of Mimas, which looks kind of like the Death Star. And I just want to say kind of in passing that Rhea, this is now I'm on slide number 18. Rhea seems to be dead from all evidence, both theoretical, you know, it's kind of far out from Saturn, it doesn't have any tidal forces, and it's kind of being used as a dead object in comparison to others. There's no evidence for activity. Of course, there's that interesting ring that there is evidence for. So we have the three satellites we're looking at, Dione, Tethys, and Mimas. We're looking for activity. So let me talk about some recent work that I and some students, my group here at JPL, has been working on. We're not working on heat. That's the SEERS instrument, but I'm sure that if SEERS had found heat from any of these objects, we would have heard about it. John Spencer and John Pearl, of course, are heading that up. And so far as I know, it's negative. But there are two things. One of them is a direct observation of plumes, and that will be in the images at large solar phase angles when most of the satellite is dark. And the plumes in forward scattering kind of really get illuminated. But there's another thing that is quite interesting and we can use with the VIMS data, and that is the direct observation of the plume when the moon is in the crescent phase. It's similar to what the ISS images would show, but since the spatial resolution on VIMS is much less, it's about 1/80th what it is, typically 1/80th of what it is on ISS, we look at integral, we look at disintegrated brightness. And the reason VIMS is good is because the plumes actually appear brighter around 2 microns, much, much brighter. So we've been looking at that. And there are other ways to detect activity that I'm not going to be talking about just because, you know, I don't have the time, but this is the stuff here, observation of the atmosphere directly or through occultations. This is some work that not only VIMS people, Roger Clark, have been doing with Dione, but Candy Hansen and Amanda Hendricks have been working with the UVIS, the ultraviolet experiment, to not only detect plumes and activity, but to measure it directly, the properties of the plumes directly. In fact, some work that Candy headed up for the UVIS team gave some very good evidence for the liquid ocean on Enceladus. She was able to she and her team were able to measure the velocity of the particles in the plume using the UVIS instrument and deduced from that it had to come from a liquid source. And then the other way we detect activity is the observation of effects of plume on or any type of, you know, atmosphere or particles on the plasma around Saturn. And as I said, that was really how we got the first hint of true activity on Enceladus, and now we see the hints of that on Tethys and Dione. So let's look at some of the data. The first one I'm going to discuss, it's on slide number 20. Now, this is kind of technical and complicated, so this is going to be kind of a tutorial on how we do this, slide 20. Now, what I'm showing here is the brightness. Now, brightness is the total integrated flux. Okay, so it's the total brightness as a function of what we call solar phase angle. And I know that's kind of technical, so what I've done here is shown on the bottom here what the moon would look like at all these solar phase angles. Technically what the solar phase angle is, it's the angle between the sun, the object, and the observer, and it goes from zero when the object is fully illuminated down to 180, which is one where it's new moon, as it were. Okay, so here is a measure of the brightness of Enceladus at, I actually have two wavelengths there. I have 0.9 microns, which is kind of the end of the visible. You're getting into near infrared. And I also have 2 microns there, okay? Now, you'll notice a couple of things. First of all, even though Enceladus isn't nearly as bright at 2 microns, the plume, which you only see there at high phase angles when the light from the moon itself is kind of dim, the plume just comes out at you, not only because the planet is dim, but also because these small particles are what we call forward scattering. You're quite familiar with this if you look at dust on your windshield, your car, and if you're like me and you never wash your car, you have a lot of dust on your windshield. And if the sun is in back of you, like in the morning, you're driving away from the sun, you can't see that dust at all. But in the afternoon, if you're driving west, have you ever noticed how that sunlight, when it hits your windshield, hits that dust, and the dust particles really become visible? Well, this is exactly what happens to the plume. The sun is behind Enceladus, and those plume particles really come right out. So this is one of the most effective ways of looking, of trying to detect the plume. So you can see here in the infrared, the plume is quite here, about 160 degrees. I have a little arrow there in red showing you that most of the brightness, the integrated brightness of Enceladus is due to its plume. And this would be a very good way of detecting the plume. You know, if we go into the infrared and look at the integrated brightness of these satellites as these moons as a function of solar phase angle. That's right. Are there any questions on that? Because I know that's kind of technical. Does everybody understand it and kind of know what we're doing here? Okay. So here on slide number 21, this is the money shot, okay? And it's a little, I try to get everything on one slide, so it's kind of busy. But unfortunately, there is nothing there so far in the three satellites that we've looked at. Now, for comparison, I've shown the integrated brightness of Enceladus at 2 microns on top. Some of this data is a little bit ratty, okay? It's a little bit, because I haven't taken out certain corrections I'm supposed to take out. But the point is there that if you look at phase angles beyond about 150 degrees, the Enceladus plume just shoots right out at you at 2 microns. It's a huge increase in brightness. But none of these objects that we've looked at, Dione, Tethys, or Mimas, have any plume there that we can detect. We put upper limits of about 2 orders of magnitude. It's at least 2 orders of magnitude less. That is 1% of what we see on Enceladus. We had some false starts. There was some data on Mimas that I thought was real, but then I went back and realized it was noise. So the bottom line is we just don't see any major activity. Now, there is a footnote there, okay? You'll notice that some Enceladus data at the high phase angle here, it doesn't have a plume. Well, that's because we weren't looking at the plume. Sometimes the plume is hidden because it's like behind our field of view. Well, just because we haven't seen any activity by this method on Tethys, Dione, and Mimas doesn't mean that it's there. It just means that we didn't see it. You know, it's either sporadic or it's in an area that was hidden to the viewer. So we can't say for sure there's nothing there, but in the images we have so far, in the VIMS data we have so far, we haven't seen anything.
Bonnie, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Ish Brzee at Copernic Observatory in Vestal, New York. How long have you been observing these three moons?
Okay. We have actually been observing them on and off for the entire mission. Okay. We have been getting, there's another thing I forgot to say, and that is that, but those of you that are alert probably realize this, you know, if you look at our moon, we see it through a full excursion in phases, okay? If you look at Mercury or Venus, we can see those objects through a full excursion, you know, in phases. That is, it goes from 0 to 180 degrees. If you look in the outer solar system, if you think about it, those objects are usually illuminated from Earth, you can only see solar phase angles of 0 to about 12 degrees. You only see these objects when they're near, as it were, full moon.
And you have to do that during crescent stage.
Well, yes, exactly. And so we can only do this with Cassini. We can't observe its crescent phase from Earth. We can only observe its full emission. So one of the things that the scientists were fighting for to get on Cassini was to have this full range solar phase angles. So there's a lot of interesting things you can find out about an object from looking at solar phase curve. I mean, not just plumes. You can understand how rough it is, how fluffy it is. There are all sorts of things. But for this topic today, we're just talking about the high solar phase angles. So in answer to your question, we have been observing these objects. You know, we try to get a couple images every month or two so we can fill in the solar phase curve because it changes all the time. But the observations at large solar phase angles, there's only a handful. We've only observed it maybe typically two or three times at those large solar phase angles.
And it doesn't help to use occultation images with Saturn in the background?
I think because the signal is so small that correcting for Saturn in the background would, so you're talking about using Saturn as the occulting device.
Yeah.
I think the problem there is, you know, it's not a point source. And since we're looking at a very, very small, very small signal, actually the UVIS team has gotten occultations with a star. We've done that, but we've used a star instead of using Saturn.
Yeah.
But that's actually a good idea. Actually, it's a good idea. I think we looked at it, but decided that a star, because it's a point source,
mm-hmm.
and any given, you know, pixel would be brighter, we decided that that would be the most effective. And actually, the UVIS team is looking at occultations, especially for the extended mission, occultations of Dione and Tethys.
Thank you.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, the observations at high, large solar phase angles are kind of rare. We only have, like, I think Dione is our best one. In fact, it is our best one. So, and some of them are from very far away, so they're noisy, and, the data's not good. So, unfortunately, that was unsuccessful. Now, the other thing we've looked at here is, here are images of Dione. Dione is the object at which we are most likely to find activity. And one of the techniques is to look off of the... This is a high solar phase angle image of Dione. I think this was at about 154 degrees or 53 degrees. And we did two... the main technique we did here is we just took a scan and looked for light off of the... limb. Now, here's the problem with this. This is very tricky because there's going to be some light off the limb, okay, even in a perfect image because of things like, if you know anything about cameras or images, you know, scattered light and point spread functions. So what we did here was we're pretty sure that Rhea is dead. There's no evidence that there's any activity on Rhea. So we took a ratio of Dione and Rhea, and we compared it. And here on the lower right, this is slide number 22. You can see that there's virtually no. It's actually that left edge. That's the limb that we see, the area that we'd expect to see the signal. You can see that Rhea and Dione are very, very similar. We don't see any evidence for any brightening off the limb of Dione. However, maybe that's not where the plume is. You know, maybe it's on the other side. The satellite. I mean, we have images of Enceladus that show no plume, you know, images, high phase angle images, because the plume was just hidden. So even though this particular image doesn't show a plume, it doesn't mean it's not there. It's just so far we haven't found it. And here, I actually looked at the VIMS image. I can't show you the ISS image. You can look at it because the data is still proprietary. I haven't analyzed it. Only people on the imaging team can analyze it. I'm on the VIMS team, but I can analyze VIMS data. You can actually see the raw image, though, on the VIMS on the Cassini website if you go there. But I'm showing you the VIMS image at 165 degrees. Here, this is slide number 23. And there is absolutely nothing there. I mean, not only can we not see the plume, but we can't even see the surface crescent. So I did actually go to the ISS image and look, and it's actually in the field of view. There is Dione in there, but there's no evidence for a plume at 165 degrees. So it looks, so far, even though maps, let's just get to the summary slide, and then I'll take more questions. I've talked for almost an hour, so I'm going to stop. Even though there's MAPS evidence, that MAPS is the fields and particles instruments, there's evidence for Tethys and Dione in the form of what look like separate streams coming from the two moons and interacting with the magnetic field and particles, charged particles, around Saturn. Okay, there is that data. But there is no evidence for any of these three objects, Tethys, Dione, and Mimas. Actually, I'm still looking at the Tethys and Mimas midges. I haven't quite finished that analysis. But so far, there's no obvious evidence in either VIMS or the visual infrared mapping spectrometer or the imaging science data. But I have to put in that footnote that any activity on these satellites might be sporadic, that it might be episodic, it might happen, and then it might be quiet, or maybe we just haven't gotten the right viewing geometry just to see the plume. So far, there's nothing really exciting new to report, although we have done a pretty thorough analysis of at least the VIMS data. We've really looked at the high solar phase angle data and have found nothing. Okay, I'm going to stop there and take more questions. It's always nicer to give a positive result, but there is still some possibility that there's something on Tethys and Mimas, but I'm not quite ready for prime time on that. It hasn't been published yet or peer reviewed, so I would rather keep that for later. Are there any questions about anything or ideas? Has anybody, maybe I'll ask some questions. Has anybody ever seen Enceladus through a telescope? Some of you out there from planetaria and observatories? Anybody? Like during ring plane crossing or any other?
And I've seen Enceladus through my telescopes.
Okay, when did you see it?
Well, when it's as far as as far from the rings as it gets. So it's when it's at its furthest point. I've seen it this year.
We are pretty near ring plane crossing.
Exactly, and it's very difficult to see. But I've seen it quite a few times. It's one of my, I always try to see as many of the Saturn moons as I can when I look. Mm-hmm. And I have a wide variety of telescopes. So
great.
Yeah, it's really special when you see the moons that are making so much news. It's fun to see it. It's fun to see Titan, too, of course. But it's really fun to see the little icy moons.
Yeah. And I think, if you go back to that telescopic image from the 60-inch, the thing is, Mimas, which is about the same size, look how much less bright it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one there to the right. It's the same size, but the fact that it's so much fainter means it's just not as bright. It's still pretty bright, though. It would be like slushy snow.
Iapetus is a really fun one to try to see, too, when it's at its farthest points away from Saturn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it becomes bright and
yes,
dark.
And you can really see that.
Cassini, who discovered Iapetus, correctly deduced that one side was very bright and one side very dark, because when it was on one side, it was very bright, and on one side, it almost disappeared.
Yeah, that's just so fascinating.
That it was bright on one side and very low albedo on the other. Don't be bashful.
Well, I don't know if anybody's going to have any questions, Bonnie.
Well, maybe we could ask, because I know we have some more time, don't we? I'd be glad to answer any questions about, Cassini or any of the, especially if it's questions about moons or,
Well, how about, excuse me, how about even though the talk is about other moons other than Enceladus, we do have an exciting flyby coming up.
Yes, we do.
And since there aren't that many, I shouldn't say that. There's plenty planned in the extended mission. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what we're hoping to do with the November flyby.
Okay, let me get my cheat sheet up. Okay. Yeah, Amanda Hendricks, who I work with planning these missions, has put together a very nice packet of information. I think it's mainly for the press, but I think that we put it we put it on the web, and it gives all the on the public website.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get that up so I don't say anything that's stupid or wrong. glasses. So they're basically, they're two pretty exciting images, rather Five Eyes coming up. There's one okay, November 2nd is Five Eye. And let's see, I have to get this material out. I'm just not really prepared. Okay.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. Well, I know one of them is a matte Five Eye, and I think it's E7 is a matte Five Eye, and I think E8 is the ORS flyby, okay. So, and actually, let me go back to our. No, I'm going to go back to our. I'm going to get all this information. Going to the. I have to sign into our website. Just give me a minute here. If anybody has any questions to ask while I sign into my website that gives an overview of the observations, you can answer that while I sign in. There's a secure website, so I have to put in a password.
I think we're planning some press material to be going out onto the Cassini website.
Okay.
To support that first November flyby. So that's probably the material that Amanda's been working on.
Yeah, I'm just trying to find this see archived example. Okay, let's go to that. Okay. Okay, here we go. All right. So, yes, that's correct. Okay, E7, we're going to focus on getting very close to Enceladus. In fact, we're going about 100 kilometers. That's not the closest flyby we've made, but it is going to focus on making kind of in-situ measurements of the plume, trying to, for example, you know, one of the interesting things that the CDA instrument has been looking at is they found sodium in the particles. There's this controversy, if you actually have a liquid ocean, that some of the rocks that we know that are in the core of Enceladus would dissolve into the liquid water and come out in the plumes, okay? So actually the CDA instrument has found some sodium particles, which is very good evidence that there's a liquid ocean underneath the surface, a liquid mantle. And they're going to get some good measurements to kind of confirm that. We'll be making magnetic field measurements. And then there's a flyby. These are kind of a pair of flybys in November. On November 21st, there's a flyby that's going to be about 1,600 kilometers away. And this is going to be mainly focused on imaging and taking spectra. You know, if you come too close to the satellite, you go by so fast you can't get very good images. So the irony is, if you're taking images and spectra and what we call the optical remote sensing instruments, you actually want to back off to be about 1,000 to 3,000 kilometers away. But if you want to measure the plume, kind of like sample the particles, you want to get down as far as possible. So that's one reason why we need so many flybys. We need some that get close in, which are basically sampling, almost in-situ type observations that the fields and particles really love. And then the far away flybys, relatively far away, where we look at, try to get spectra of areas and try to monitor the plumes. So that's kind of an overview of those flybys.
So we have a lot to look forward to there. And then that we're going to be flying by some of the smaller satellites, too, coming up.
That's right, yeah. One of the most interesting observations are some of these small guys are kind of, you know, forgotten, you know, these forgotten bodies. Things like they used to be called Shepherd satellites, but now we know they're not really Shepherd satellites. We used to think that they confined the rings of Saturn, but we now know that they really are actually confined by the particle motions themselves. But those are right outside of the rings, and then the co-orbital satellites that exchange orbits every 4 years. They're probably once the same object. And we have, I think, the best ever so far coming up, observation of Janus, which is one of the co-orbitals. And we also have, right after the flyby, we have a very good shot of Rhea. This is the inactive satellite. But that's also in the same rev. We're going to get some very good images of Rhea, some areas that we haven't seen before. Those wispy streaks, those faults that we see in some of those satellites, we'll get some very good images there. So that's pretty exciting.
So we really never run out of things to do on Cassini.
No, there's so much data that we're overwhelmed and we really can't keep on top of it, you know. That's for sure.
Well, does anybody else have any questions for Bonnie?
I don't think so.
The quiet group.
Did you say that she was also working a little bit on New Horizons?
Yeah, I'm on the
yes.
New Horizons science team. That's correct, yes.
Did you just want to tease us with a few things that you're working on?
Well, we're, you know, there is a system we've never been to. It's not like the Saturn system where, you know, we kind of have been there once before. But here's the thing where, you know, I mean, I expect we're gonna find a bunch of moons, you know. I mean, we talked about Charon, the main moon, you know, which in comparison to Pluto is larger than, you know, any other, you know, moon and planet. But, you know, Hubble Space Telescope recently found Nixon Hydra, which
mm-hmm.
are the two smaller moons of Pluto. But I think we're going to find a whole slew of moons because we think that Charon formed the same way, Charon or Charon, astronomers, you know, pronounce it different ways, formed the same way that our Earth's moon did from an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of debris left over from that impact. So I think that's going to be the most exciting thing. But what might even be more exciting is if we find if we find any activity. You know, when we found activity on Triton, these plumes, these geysers, I mean, you know, here's an object that's cold. It's like 37 Kelvin. And it still has activity. It still has solar-driven plumes. So, you know, we might find something like that at Pluto. Pluto is the same distance when it comes, you know, as you know, it has an eccentric orbit, so sometimes it's 30 astronomical units and you can get as much as 50. When it's in during perihelion, which just passed about 10 years ago, it was as close into the sun as Triton, as Neptune. Triton is the satellite of Neptune. So I would expect that, you know, maybe we'll see some activity on Pluto. Wouldn't that be exciting? I mean, I think that's a much more important question than, you know, is Pluto a planet or not, whether it's active or not. But that's one of the things we're going to be looking for very, very carefully.
Thank you.
This is Jason Kendall at New York. Just a quick question about how do your studies fit in with the astrobiology questions that are always on NASA's front side?
Yes, very good question. Thank you for that question. You know, astrobiology, you know, which I think is a very important field, the search for life is really the search for liquid water. And one of the signals, the signs of liquid water, is active geology. It is pretty certain that Enceladus has a liquid mantle. We're also certain, I mean, pretty relatively certain, that Europa has a liquid ocean. That's a lot more solid, no anti-pun intended. Europa probably has a liquid ocean because it's bigger, so it's easier to measure its gravitational properties. So Galileo was able to measure a lot more certainly that there is a liquid ocean there, and there's better geologic evidence. But those are two bodies, Europa and Enceladus, where, you know, there's a possibility, I have to emphasize we haven't found evidence, that there might be primitive life forms. We, you know, things like bacteria. We know now that, you know, the current theory on the formation of life on the Earth is that it formed from these thermal vents, these oceanic thermal vents. And, you know, Enceladus would very likely have something similar to that because it's got a source of heat. And we know that heat comes out to the surface and expels water out. So it's quite possible that these are environments for very primitive forms of life. Of course, the other area we're looking at very carefully is Mars, because there we're pretty certain that there was flowing, you know, liquid water and probably even standing liquid water, and that life could have formed early in the wetter, warmer period of the history of Mars, and that life has since hunkered down in maybe some subsurface area. But again, I have to emphasize, we have found no evidence for life on any planet other than the Earth. We've just found conditions where primitive life, you know, may have arisen.
Well, has there been, I guess I've not seen it, or maybe I'm just, you know, I work Wall Street during the day, so I'm kind of hovering around. So has there been spectroscopy done on the tiger stripes or on the folded regions on Enceladus to see if there's IR signatures, specifically IR signatures that indicate either bioorganics or simple bioorganics like amino?
No, you asked really good questions for a banker.
Well, you know, somebody's got to have a hobby.
Yes, we have been doing that, and the VINS instrument has found what are light organics, and the CDA instrument has found evidence for also light organics, things that have, you know, a couple of carbon or hydrogen. There is the prebiotic material there. There is evidence for it. It's in kind of low abundance, but I'm not aware if there's been any theory though on top of that, you know, to show, you know, we know so little about the origin of life that, you know, even to go to the next step, is there enough prebiotic material there to provide food for possibly, you know, primitive organisms? But yes, there are organics, light organics, on the around the tiger stripes and in the plume. In fact, you brought up a very interesting point here that prebiotic material, hydrocarbons, things that have carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, really couldn't have formed in the early Earth because it was too hot. You know, they don't form easily under heat. So scientists think that a lot of these materials were formed in the outer solar system. I mean, we see this dark material in Iapetus and some of the other satellites that it's rich in even complex organics. There's a paper by Dale Cruikshank where he has identified polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons on Iapetus. So we believe that, now that we haven't found that on Enceladus yet, but it's in other places of the Saturnian system, that some of this material was transported into the inner solar system by comets. You know, we now know that comets come, most of them, the short-period comets come from the Kuiper Belt. And the Kuiper Belt is probably also has a lot of the that kind of organic prebiotic matter. And as comets came into the inner solar system, they transported that material to the Earth, which provided, you know, and you could keep some of it stable in the interior of the comet that was encapsulated from the heat. So we think that some of that prebiotic material may have actually led the same stuff that we see currently in the Saturnian system may have been transported earlier to the inner solar system and formed the building blocks for life.
Any more questions? Now's your chance.
Somebody, you know, people can email me, too, if they think of questions later.
Well, Bonnie, how about if we end the Charm Telecon for this week, and thank you very much for an awesome talk. Like Bonnie said, if you have any questions, you can either send them to her or to, you know, you all received an announcement of this meeting, of this telecon, and so you've got a contact number at the bottom of that email, just in case you don't have her direct email, and we'll make sure that we get it to Bonnie. And we look forward to hearing more about IC satellites, including Enceladus and Pluto, as we get further on. Although we won't do that in Cassini, but we'll be hearing about that through the Pluto website for New Horizons. Anybody final questions, or should we all thank Bonnie?
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Bonnie.
There.
Thank you.
Okay, how about that? Is that will that be enough to wrap up? I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Bonnie, and I'm going to sign off now.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone, for calling in.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.